Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with four Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much.
Okay, let me ask you this way. Who are you and what do you do?
Oh, my name is Joe Napolitano, and I've been a reporter for about 20 years, and recently I wrote a book, which is pretty exciting.
And what's the name of that book?
I was going to actually give you its original title, which was The Case Against Kids, and it like took me a minute to get the right title.
Wait, what was it called originally?
It was called The Case Against Kids. That's what it was for years, because I felt at the time America was making like a case against a certain type of kid. But when we took it to the publishing houses, some of them were like, oh, is this a book about why people shouldn't have children? And so we're like, no. So the title was changed. So yes, it's called The School I Deserve, Six Young Refugees and Their Fight for Equality in America by Beacon Press.
From West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, you're listening to Us and Them, the show that tells the stories about the things that divide us. I'm Trey Kay. My friend Joe Napolitano's book is actually about the case against some kids. Tells the story of school kids who immigrate to the United States not knowing English. Joe follows six refugees who became part of a historic court case. They're actually denied access to K-12 education because they were 17 or older when they arrived. I know Joe from the Spencer Fellowship Program at the Columbia University School of Journalism. I was a fellow a few years back when I was working on a project about curriculum battles in Texas, and Joe was a fellow a few years later as she was reporting on this new book.
I think the water is boiled, honey.
We became friends. Joe has many talents, and lucky me, cooking is one of them.
I have eggs, because I know Oren will eat them if I make them.
Besides being an excellent cook, Joe is an expert on how immigrant and refugee kids get educated in this country, or don't. It's more than just a professional interest of hers.
I was actually born in Bogota, Colombia, and adopted to the States, so I feel like I have a huge us and them kind of built into who I am, like just by the chance that I grew up on Long Island and, you know, attended college here, I became part of us, but had that not happened, I would have been part of them. You know, so we have all of these kind of ways to divide people, and seeing immigrant kids as someone else's problem or someone else's responsibility and not ours is kind of, it makes it easy to marginalize this group of people when we just won't identify with them.
So how was it that you came to learn of the situation that was going on in Lancaster, Pennsylvania?
So when I was a reporter at Newsday and I saw it happening on Long Island, I kind of wondered, are they having an easy time enrolling in other parts of the country and it's just here that's a problem? So I literally went on LexisNexis and typed in, I believe it was immigrant and education, and I came up with hundreds of stories of these children trying to enroll or just moving into certain communities around the country and being met with enormous pushback, both by local residents and in some cases schools. And so learning that, I then called 37 of our nation's 50 ACLUs and asked, do you have any case that's about to go to trial?
ACLU is the American Civil Liberties Union.
And everyone said, no. And then finally, this one woman called back who was like a secretarial staff at one of the ACLUs and said, I don't know if you really care about this or if this is what you're looking for, but there happens to be a case going before a federal judge next week in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And I was like, what?
That was 2016. Joe dropped everything and began reporting the story that became her book. The ACLU was representing six refugees ages 17 to 21. They were being denied access to the district's high school, even though it had a program for English language learners. The district told the students they were too old for high school. One of those students was Khadija Issa, who fled war in Sudan and had been living in a refugee camp in Chad. She was 17 years old when she came to Pennsylvania with her mother and five younger siblings. Refugee groups found the family an apartment, got them vaccinated, and enrolled them in school.
It went great for everybody except Khadija. She was the one the district told, you're too old to go to school. According to Khadija, they said, you know, you are too old to go to school. You should go look for work instead, which was just stunning and appalling. And Khadija is an extremely intelligent, diligent, very disciplined, hardworking person. She wasn't a kid who kind of shrugged about school. I'm not really sure. That is all she wanted. So to tell her no was devastating.
Khadija had the equivalent of a sixth grade education when she came to the United States in 2015. But she had learned one thing for sure. Education was the key to a better life. She was only five when her family was forced to leave Sudan. A militia called the Janjaweed was trying to exterminate ethnic Sudanese, including Khadija's people, the Four. Her family joined thousands of refugees, determined to cross the river to neighboring Chad. Once they got there, Khadija was left to care for her little sister, while their parents went looking for work, or when they had to, would beg for food. The UN took months to build a refugee camp, and that's where Khadija's family lived off and on for the next 9 years. Joe showed me a picture.
This is not the dwelling they lived in Chad, but I can explain this photo if you'd like.
Please.
So when they got to Chad in the refugee camp, the UN had issued like a UN-issued tent, which they kind of described as like a large white tent. The problem with that, it was like a real heat trap. And so Khadija's father replaced their tent with a straw hut.
The family settled into life in the refugee camp. But a few years later, Khadija's father drowned on his way home from work. Her mother remarried and had three more children. The family waited many years for permission to come to the U.S. And when it did, the permission did not include Khadija's stepfather. So, in October 2015, the family moved to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, to a modest apartment with secondhand furniture. Joe showed me photos of the family's first home in America.
You can see the blinds are kind of messed up and there's holes in the windows here.
It looks like a kind of a makeshift banister as they're walking up to the door. You can see drainage stains and chips in the bricks and stuff like that. So this wasn't doesn't look like it was...
Not luxury living, no. This was a very modest apartment. I mean, the paint was peeling on the inside. It was in pretty rough shape. This is a photo of Khadija, and she was actually looking through some graduation materials. And this is like an old donated couch, as you can see, that her mom is sitting on. And you can see the walls here haven't been painted in a very, very long time.
The neighborhood was not the best. Khadija's family saw a new kind of violence. Street shootings and armed robberies. One of Khadija's brothers had his bike stolen. Khadija was threatened with a knife. They all worried about their safety. But at least Khadija's younger siblings were enrolled in schools, where they began learning English and catching up on academics. Pennsylvania law says students are entitled to public education until they're 21. But officials told Khadija she was too old to start school. Better to just get a job.
And it looked for a while like she would go no further, that we were just going to have a, you know, new immigrant here with a sixth grade education, totally unable to speak English.
But isn't that how she is seen by the school system, which is, come on, how are we going to get her from here to here in such a short period of time where she is going to be at the level of her peers, and that she's going to immigrate into society? Wouldn't it just be better for her to kind of get a job? Isn't that what the school system was thinking?
I mean, it's hard for me to say exactly what they thought. I can tell you what they decided to do with her, because she kept pushing, you know, for enrollment. They decided to place her in an alternative school.
Because Khadija and her advocates did not back down, district officials put her in a school for students considered marginal. The graduation rate was just a little over 50%. That's what officials decided about Khadija and the other older refugees. They were unlikely to graduate.
And their thinking in doing that was, the alternative school actually operates at a faster rate. It's a school that's set up for kids who've already kind of failed out of the regular high school, or maybe they're pregnant, or maybe they want to join the workforce, and they just need your basic education delivered quickly. So they ultimately put Khadija and a few of the other refugees in this alternative school, which, by the way, was privately run, outsourced, apart from the district in some ways, in very critical ways, and that's where Khadija was ultimately placed.
Coming up, we hear from Khadija Issa about her experience in the alternative school and what it took to get her out of there. Even if you could read the book, it might be hard to do because there are people throwing paper balls and joking and
yes, and that's what make you bring, like, it will mess your brain.
It will mess your brain.
Because you're not gonna know what you're doing, like.
So it was a big distraction.
Yes.
You're listening to Us and Them. This program is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council and the CRC Foundation.
In difficult times, music gives us peace, brings us together, and helps heal us. It calms our nerves and brightens our days. That's why we're bringing you classic episodes of Mountain Stage on air and in our podcast. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find something that's familiar or brand new and feel the power of live music on our website, mountainstage.org.
Hey, it's Trey, and you're listening to Us and Them from PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. I visited Khadija Issa in Lancaster not too long ago. She's 22 now and married with a baby. She attends classes at Harrisburg Community College, and she wants to be a nurse.
I don't came here in this country just to waste my time. I came here to learn and have something better.
Khadija says she did not come to America to waste her time, but to work for something better. And she wasn't about to let the Lancaster School District stop her.
No, that's not what we came here for. We came here to learn. To learn.
And when the school district said no, she was too old to learn, Khadija and her refugee advocates fought back. So the school district said, okay, we'll put you in an alternative school.
It is called Phoenix Academy. It's run by a private company called Camelot Education, which runs about 40 such schools around the country, kind of aimed at what you might have called at-risk kids. As soon as you walk in, students are patted down. They go through a metal detector. They have wands there, or they're like physically patted down, which for refugees, by the way, is really shocking. Khadija had never experienced anything like that. And some of these cultures, they're fairly modest cultures where girls are not used to being touched by a stranger kind of intimately, like feeling, you know, across the bra straps, a quick swipe between the breasts, like kind of just, you know, they want to make sure kids aren't bringing in weapons, drugs, cell phones, money. This school is very strict. Kids are not allowed to bring in backpacks, purses, tampons, maxi pads, nothing. You cannot bring in that stuff. They don't want kids bringing in bags.
So you don't bring in a bag. When I went to school, in my backpack were books that I was going to take home for homework. How did they take work home for homework?
They didn't. And so what happened was they felt that, you know, our texts and our materials are so expensive, we don't trust that the kids are going to bring them back. Not that they're going to, you know, steal them or something, but we're not going to give them the opportunity to lose something. So everything you need to do, you can do here. You could stay, you know, come before school, come after school, do your homework kind of on site if you need to. Or they claim to sometimes Xerox things and give the kids that. But Khadijah did not get that. So every day she was coming home from school, from Phoenix Academy, with no homework, no ability. And all the immigrants complained about this. No ability to reinforce their English skills at home or do any. And she, this is a child so eager to study. This girl just wanted, give me a book so I can read. Like, that's what she wanted to do.
Khadijah says she hated the Phoenix Academy. The daily searches offended her.
Like a criminal, like you're a criminal.
Khadijah didn't understand how to learn when she wasn't allowed to bring books home to study. There was no homework. Yet every day, the worksheets handed out during class got harder. So just, they handed you a book in a language that you just not know, you did not know how to read.
Yeah.
And they expected you to learn.
Yes, and the teacher would go outside and say, oh, start reading, and he's outside. And the door is locked.
Khadijah said that most days, the teacher left the students alone in the classroom, locking the door behind him when he left. Wait, I want to make sure I got that right. So there you're in class, there's a teacher, they put a book in front of you, and they say, okay, read this chapter, read this page, and then they locked the door and went outside. And when the teacher left, the students didn't even pretend to study.
The teacher will go outside and leave all the students in a classroom, and other students, they're just playing, sleeping, nothing else.
So they were
playing their games.
Playing games like on a phone.
I was throwing stuff on each student, like, you know, you will make a piece of paper like a ball and then just keep throwing like that.
Khadijah says that despite the spitballs and mayhem, she would ask for help, but no one heard her. No one was listening.
So wait. So what I'm trying to get this idea is that, well, at first you can't read the book. There's a book that you're trying to read because you're trying to learn. The teacher's not in the room. They lock the door.
When you call for help. Yeah, when you call for help, when you call the teacher for help, the teacher's outside. How are you supposed to get a help?
And even if you could read the book, it might be hard to do because there are people throwing paper balls and joking and
yes. And that's what make you bring, like, it will mess your brain.
It will mess your brain.
Because you're not gonna know what you're doing, like.
So it was a big distraction.
Yes.
Let's be clear here. Khadijah says while she was a student at Phoenix Academy, the teacher would leave students to work on their own. The result? A chaotic classroom that would mess with your brain. Joe Napolitano says at Phoenix Academy, discipline wasn't a priority.
The kids felt it was a very hostile environment. Their experience, the refugees felt very attacked by this. They felt the other kids were really aggressive with them, and they were, you know, yelling at them in a language they can't understand, kind of barking orders at them. And it was definitely an environment that they found was really, I don't want to say antagonistic, but very intimidating.
It seems like it's a school where they are sending kids who are having problems, behavioral problems. And I guess to the system, the older refugee kids were a problem, but a different type of problem. And yet this, it didn't seem to me like the Phoenix Academy was the solution to the problem that students like Khadijah presented?
Well, that was definitely an argument in court when they, you know, when the ACLU and Education Law Center attorneys who were fighting on Khadijah's behalf and on the behalf of other kids, they looked at the description of the school. You know, it's a school for at-risk kids who had previous behavior problems or flunked out of certain courses or this and that. And they asked the, you know, school leadership in court, were these kids problem kids? Did they have a problem background? Had they gotten into fights before or flunked out of class or any of the other things that got kids sent here? And then the answer, of course, was no. You know, so it's like, okay, then we have to ask ourselves, why are we sending them here? And what language support are we giving them? I mean, according to Khadijah and the other refugees, the answer was zero. They said they didn't have translators. They didn't have, you know, Google Translate. They didn't have live translators that could call in on the phone as they used in court to testify. Now, the school said, oh, we offered all those things. And the kids in court, unless they all perjured themselves, said, no, you didn't, or you certainly didn't offer it to me, and I never had it. So I'm sitting here in a class, and I can't even tell you the subject I am studying. I literally don't know the name of this class.
Well, so you're there in the trial. In your book, you say that there were six young people that you followed or that were a part of this lawsuit. Did they testify?
Oh, yes. All six testified in court. I believe Khadijah might have been the first. And they testified with the help of translators who were like a call-in service.
So they all testified, but not in English.
Correct. Right. None of them were able to speak English well enough, nearly well enough, to testify in court.
Isn't that in itself self-evident as to what is, if they were getting an education? I mean, that to me would be like pretty much the first thing that you would say, the judge would say, well, gosh, if they were being educated well enough, at least maybe one of them could testify in English.
You know, it's funny you should say that because that came up during the trial when it was debated, how much do these kids really know? Maybe they speak better English than they're really showing us. So at one point, the school district's attorney, she made the kids read passages that they had written in English as part of their coursework weeks earlier. And they wrote beautifully, and they could read some of that material fairly well. And so that made everyone like, wait a minute, you can't speak enough English to testify in court, but you could write paragraphs of information in English. Then we had a second person come in, an expert, who said, the kids do this all the time, learning English. They will copy exactly what it says on the board and then ask them to read it, and they can't, or ask them what it means, and they can't. So the fact that they were able to write a passage in English is not indicative of their ability to speak and understand English.
The trial took place in federal court in August 2016. Later that month, a judge ruled the Lancaster School District had violated the Equal Education Opportunities Act. He said the six students had to be enrolled in regular public school, the one where Khadijah's younger sister was doing so well. But the case wasn't over. The district appealed. The ACLU asked for and won an emergency injunction. In January of 2017, the case was finally settled. Khadijah would go to school.
What exactly was at stake in the case?
In my opinion, the future of six human beings and their partners and their own children and generations to come behind them. In other words, the ability of these six people, who represented a much larger group of people, to get an education, which is completely transformative. And so if they could not get a high school degree or diploma, they cannot then go on to community college and get a job that pays decent money. Had this played out in a way that she lost and was really kept out of her education, we would be down a nurse. Do you know a community in the United States that doesn't need a nurse? Because last I checked, nurses were in tremendous demand. Do we not need a person who speaks Arabic in this country who could be a nurse? Well, Khadijah speaks Arabic, Fur, and English. I cannot fathom a world in which she is not an asset and won't be an asset when she completes her education.
Because of the court ruling, Khadijah enrolled at McCaskey, a regular public school with a rigorous program for English language learners.
She was a great student. She was a really, really great student, popular with her peers and, you know, really well-loved.
Joe shows me a photo of a printout of a human skeleton with handwritten answers about what all the bones are called.
This is basically something that would be from an anatomy class that is hopefully gearing her up for her nursing. Yeah.
And as you can see, her teacher gave her 100% and a smiley face. And it just makes me, this is a child that the school said this isn't a place for you. And then when she was put in the right program in the mainstream campus and in the niche of her wanting to study nursing, she got 100. How much better than 100 can you get?
So how is your life now?
My life is so much better now. I can really see what is different before and now, because now I know everything. I can read, I can understand. And then it's so much better now. It's different completely.
What does this story tell us about America right now?
I think it tells us something phenomenal about this country. I think the way this case played out in the courts before a conservative Republican judge, the way he looked at what the kids were asking for and decided basically in their favor, in my opinion, this shows America works, frankly. They brought with them here an incredible, impenetrable faith in America as a land of opportunity. Nobody could tell them differently. And even after they were met with this huge obstacle, Khadijah knew this isn't the America I know. Like, you guys are making a mistake. When this is really seen and figured out, clearly the America I know will always be on my side.
Khadijah continues to take ESL classes, English as a second language, at a community college. She's hopeful this will be her last year. She's determined to become a registered nurse and to set an example, not just for her baby daughter, but for other refugees and immigrants.
I feel like this thing, like this all process, is just give me more confident about who I am. And that's how I feel it. And that's who am I want to be.
And you say that in many ways this is not just for you, but it's for other people, other immigrants who are trying.
Immigrant who's trying to come in this country so they kiss their kids can go, because they don't have to go back to that process that I went through.
Do you feel like a leader?
For myself? Well, yeah. Because I open a door for other kids, not only for myself.
Khadijah Issa has become a United States citizen and is taking courses at Harrisburg Community College toward a nursing degree. And Khadijah's mother has passed her United States citizenship test. As I wrapped up our interview and was putting away my gear, Khadijah fussed over me in a way that I've come to understand is a show of hospitality when Muslim people have guests in their home. Khadijah observed that I was feeling tired, and she insists on making me a cup of coffee. Now, I don't drink a lot of coffee, and as it turns out, neither does Khadijah. But she really wanted me to have a cup. And because she is so positive and enthusiastic, I couldn't turn it down. While Khadijah bustled around in the kitchen, she left her tiny daughter, Zainab, on my lap. And as I looked at this child, I could not help thinking about the immense struggle her family had gone through just to get to this place. Khadijah returns with my coffee. As I drink, Khadijah's husband, Suleiman, enters the room. It's afternoon, and he's just got up and is about to leave for his night shift job. Maybe it was just the day I was there. Or maybe it was Khadijah and Suleiman putting on a happy face for a reporter. But from my perspective, they seem to be like two glass-half-full people, excited about the prospects of making their lives in America.
You've been listening to Us and Them. Our team for this show is me, Trey Kay, Lori Stern, Brad Stratton, and Kate Smith. Special thanks to Linnell Hancock and the Spencer Fellowship for Education Reporting at the Columbia University School of Journalism. Michael Lipton and Tristram Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. Lelena Price provides us with images for the web. The wonderful people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and the CRC Foundation. Us and Them was originally developed with assistance from the mentorship program at AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. We'll see you next time on Us and Them.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.